going to be working with us, I presume, I trust. And we're just glad that all of you are with us. And so as we celebrate your marriages, some of you may be aware that Peter and Catherine got married yesterday. And a few of us got to share with Austin and Erica, some young man we studied with for about 3 years. They got married yesterday. And some of you can remember, I hope John and Samantha can remember, that they got married not too long ago. And some of you got married just about a year ago, and now the in-laws or the outlaws have come to check on you, Eric. And by the way, there's just been a lot of marriages going on. And that's a wonderful thing, because our culture is pretty much down on marriage. And so for those of you who've chosen to take that radical act, yes, Mike and Anna, you're among them, that have made that radical choice to commit yourself to God and to each other for life, that's just a radical thing to do, especially in our culture. And so I'd like to commend you in that regard and to celebrate those things, and then in some way to sound a warning about some things that have occurred just recently. Some of us are so old that we can remember some things that occurred a long time ago. I think I was 5 years old when it happened. And I remember people talking about it that November day when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And then I can remember being at band camp in August 9th of 1974, and we actually turned on a TV and read or listened to President Richard M. Nixon resigning from office over the Watergate scandal. But I must confess to you that back in 1973, Roe versus Wade was not on my radar. I was probably, maybe a sophomore in high school. And I didn't know anything about what was going on with the Supreme Court. I did know that there were some girls who were getting pregnant, but then seemed like they weren't pregnant anymore. But I didn't really have a clue about what was going on in our country and the cataclysmic shift that would occur and the 50 to 60 million babies that would be aborted from then till now. But that was a seismic shift in American culture. But then another one has occurred just on Friday this past week. And that one had to do with Obergefell versus Hodges. That's the way it's going to be known in the courts. But there has been a decision made in regard to marriage. And rather than me trying to speak in legalese terminology, we'll briefly let some of those who have made that decision speak for themselves. But for those of you who are visiting with us, this is not about legal cases. This is not about the courts. This is about what God says about fundamental things like life and marriage. And so we'll be looking at societal views briefly and then focus on what Jesus has to say in regard to the wonderful relationship of marriage. And so Chief Justice John Roberts, if we might let him speak first, he says, if you are among the many Americans of whatever sexual orientation who favor expanding same-sex marriage, by all means, celebrate today's decision. Celebrate the achievement of a desired goal. Celebrate the availability of new benefits, he wrote. But do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it. He's exactly right. And then there's a fellow who's getting pretty well bashed as a court justice by the media. His name is Antonin Scalia. And he said that when the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, every state limited marriage to one man and one woman. No one doubted the constitutionality of doing so. That resolves these cases. No one thought in 1868 that when we gave the statements that all people had the right, all people, getting rid of these Jim Crow laws, all people had the right to practice liberty and justice, we weren't talking about same-sex marriage. But another one of the justices named Anthony Kennedy has said, and this is where you need to notice the handwriting on the wall, the generations that wrote and ratified the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment did not presume to know the extent of freedom in all its dimensions. And so they entrusted to future generations a character protecting the right of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning. Now, that's telling you about how the justices view the Constitution of the United States. that it's a fluid document that can constantly be reevaluated and can be adjusted based upon whatever we perceive is the liberty of the people. That's serious when you think about how we view God's Constitution. This was not a judicial decision based upon law, but rather an expansion of legislation by the judicial branch of government. What I'm suggesting to you, and I'm particularly thinking about those who are 13 to 25 or so, as far as your critical thinking analysis, the tide has turned. Most folks knew this was coming who had any political awareness, because in 2013, in the case of United States versus Windsor, there were significant changes that were coming. In 2001, 57% of Americans opposed same-sex marriage. Today, 57% support it. Now, that's according to Pew Research Center. And so you can just start adding up the numbers and see the seismic shift in view in a relatively short time in regard to that concept. But in that court case back in 2013 that I mentioned, Scalia wrote in the minority dissent, "By formally declaring anyone opposed to same-sex marriage an enemy of human decency, the majority arms well every challenger to a state law restricting marriage to its traditional definition." What happened was people were polarized based on accusations. And what you notice there, an enemy of human decency, anyone who would question the right of anyone to claim to be married to anyone was actually indecent and opposed to any human decency. And so one of the fellows that has tried for the last two or three years particularly, as a visiting Harvard professor, to state what marriage is about, along with Sharif Girgis and Ryan Anderson, who wrote the document, What is Marriage? I have a copy, you can read it. But what Robert P. George tried to emphasize to our culture in a non-religious setting was that marriage has always been defined in cultures as one man and one woman. And it was for the purpose of procreation. But Mr. George was invited to speak at a national prayer breakfast at a college, at a Catholic organization. And I just want to share a little bit of what he had to say. And for all of you who want a full manuscript document of the outline, be glad to provide it for you. I didn't do a condensed outline this time. I promised you I'd send it to you by email. You shall receive it, Lord willing, and technology does not die. And so I'd like for you to think about some things that Mr. George said back in May of last year in 2014. He said the days of socially acceptable Christianity are over. It is no longer easy to be a faithful Christian, an authentic witness to the truths of the gospel. A price is demanded and must be paid. There are costs of discipleship, heavy costs, costs that are burdensome and painful to bear. I'm thinking of a man by the name of Bob Waldron who spoke to a group of teenagers in Alabama about 14 years ago. And he said, "You young people are in a period of blessing and persecution." He said, "Your light is going to burn brighter as Christians as our world becomes darker." He could see on the horizon the changes so that people who were Christians were no longer in the norm, no longer were in the majority. People who were going to serve Jesus Christ were going to be the outcast of society. And we have thought that could never happen in America. I must remind you it happened really fast in the 1920s in Germany. And so as you will think about these kind of choices, to choose to be a Christian in 21st century America is going to cost. It's not going to be politically correct. Surely we've realized that already. But it's going to cost us in lots of different ways. As churches and as individuals, as employees, as employers, as students, as academicians, it's going to cost. Some of you already know some of those costs. You're already experiencing them, particularly in the academic world. Some of you in your orientation training, in your particular areas of manufacturing. So Mr. George goes on to say, he says, "Powerful forces and currents in our society press us to be ashamed of the gospel ashamed of the good, ashamed of our, and I made an adjustment here, scriptures, the teachings on the sanctity of human life in all stages and conditions, ashamed of our faith teaching on marriage as the conjugal, coming together union of husband and wife. These forces insist that the Bible, Mr. George said the church, teachings are out of date, retrograde, insensitive, uncompassionate, I realized I didn't have you a slide for that one, illiberal, bigoted, even hateful. Anyone who would say that there is the right to life, anyone who would say that marriage is a conjugal relationship of a man and woman, that you are bigoted, you are uncompassionate, you're even hateful. These currents bring pressure on all of us, and on young Christians in particular, to yield to this insistence. They threaten us with consequences if we refuse to call what is good evil and what is evil good. They command us to conform our thinking to their orthodoxy or else say nothing at all. So Mr. George asks us, do you believe, as I believe, that every member of the human family, irrespective of age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency, is the bearer of inherent dignity and an equal right to life? Do you hold that the precious child in the womb, as a creature made in the very image and likeness of God, deserves respect and protection? Then powerful people and institutions say you're a misogynist. That's a hater of women. Someone who poses a threat to people's privacy, an enemy of women's reproductive freedom, you ought to be ashamed. That's what our culture tells us. And so he goes on to ask, do you believe, as I believe, that the core social function of marriage is to unite a man and a woman as husband and wife, to be mother and father to children born of their union? Do you hold, as I hold, that the norms that shape marriage as a truly conjugal partnership are grounded in its procreative nature, its singular aptness for the project of child rearing? Do you understand marriage as the uniquely comprehensive type of bond? Comprehensive in that it unites spouses in a bodily way and not merely at the level of hearts and minds. That it is oriented to and would naturally be fulfilled by their conceiving and rearing children together. Then these same forces say you're a homophobe, a bigot, someone who doesn't believe in equality. You even represent a threat to people's safety. I'm not typically a political kind of person, but when it comes to spiritual and moral truths, I perk up a little bit in regard to what's happening in my home and yours, in our church, and in our community. I want us to realize, as we think about these truths, when judicial courts speak about the subject of marriage, I want us to recognize that enacting same-sex civil marriage would not be and was not an expansion of the institution of marriage. It was a redefinition. This was some redefining of what marriage is. It was now simply an emotional union. This action, begun by the no-fault divorce concepts, finally would replace the conjugal view of marriage in our society. So for those of us who want to blame the young people for this, this stuff started back in the 60s. And now we're reaping the whirlwind of what was going on when we were advocating free love. And so as we think about these two views of marriage, back a couple of years ago, we discussed that. And time will not permit, and we're not going to take time to address that again. But I'd encourage you to think about, what is marriage? Two views of marriage is being contrasted. And the book that I mentioned to you does not argue for marriage from a religious perspective, but rather from a definition of and a societal benefit of marriage. Do you understand when there's no marriage, the society is going to die? Do you understand when there's no children, society is going to die? Do you understand when people have no regard for commitment to one another in marriage, that society is going to die? And so this is so critical in those regards to think about that. I think Maggie Gallagher was right when she said getting married is the boldest and most idealistic thing that most of us will ever do. I remember Paul Earnhardt saying years ago that marriage is a radical act. And indeed it is. You are trusting everything about yourself. You're completely trusting someone else to respect you and to honor you and to be committed to you for life. And there are no guarantees unless there's faithfulness. And so this is what's radical. Sleeping together, hooking up with whoever from time to time, and just deciding we'll live together for a while. There's no radical act in that. That's the most safest, conservative thing you could do. But to marry, to commit to one another for life, that's radical. And so it expresses complete trust and confidence in the fidelity and faithfulness of one person, your spouse, to protect your every vulnerability. It's precisely why it's treachery and covenant breaking to prove unfaithful to that solemn trust pledged in the presence of God. So let's think about briefly. Marriage is God's idea. It's radical. It's been from the beginning. And we thank Daniel for reading that passage in Genesis 2. Let me simply emphasize, for this reason, a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. Leave, cleave, one flesh. You remember those three things, you'll have a good marriage. You disregard any one of those three, and your marriage will be significantly at risk. But if you would with me, if you'll go to Mark chapter 10, I want you to notice Jesus is going through the same thing we're going through in the 21st century. Jesus is a cousin to John. And John said some things about marriage that caused him to lose his head. And now the same area where John lost his head is the place where Jesus is being questioned about what about marriage, and more precisely, what about divorce. And they're wanting to draw on an older court case called Deuteronomy 24 to try to legitimize their putting away their wives. So they're asking Jesus to comment on what the Supreme Court of the Jews have decided. And Jesus reminds us in Mark chapter 10, as he is there attempting to trap him into this, he goes right back to Genesis 2 and says, "But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." So they're no longer two, but one flesh. You notice Jesus said that this is the way it's been from the beginning of creation. Marriage was designed by God from the very beginning with Adam and Eve. And no court of law in any society is going to be able to trump God on the matter. And so we need to understand that marriage was a pronouncement for all generations. God wasn't talking about Adam and Eve when he said, "Leave father and mother." They didn't have a father and mother to leave. God was speaking about what was going to happen in the future. And so there's a pronouncement where Jesus clearly implies some things. One of those things that Jesus implies is a man is joined to his wife. Marriage is a man and woman relationship regulated by God. It is male and female, and it's been that way from the beginning of creation. That's the only kind of marriage that God has ever approved. There is no marriage otherwise. Also, marriage is for one man and one woman. And I know there have been times when that's been disregarded. And I don't know what all God's going to do about all those polygamous situations. But I will remind you that as the laws of the land are changing, there are several folks who are already speaking of polygamous relationships as being authorized under the law. If marriage is not one man and one woman, who's to say marriage is for just two people? And so polygamy is the next agenda. And I can quote that for you if you need the resources. And so marriage is for one man and one woman. Polygamy was not tolerated under God's initial design. God gave Adam one wife, and that's his plan. Also, sexual relationship is approved in marriage and only in marriage. That's where particularly in the 1960s, we began to abandon God's principles because there were people known as swingers. Now that really dates you if you remember the swingers. Those were the men who would swap wives for a while, and then sometimes they'd swap back and sometimes they wouldn't. They were swingers. They disregarded God's basic principle of the sexual relationship being in marriage and only in marriage. Some claim that the sexual relationship is tainted and is not for those who are holy. It's not what God says on the subject. God says marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. God created that one flesh relationship. It's the only relationship in which God authorizes sexual pleasure. That's marriage. Outside of that relationship, God calls it fornication. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 6. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh. We don't have to guess what that means there. Flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a man commits are outside his body. But he who sexually sins, sins against his own body. So sensual conduct, whether or not it results in fornication, is clearly condemned by God. And the participant shall not inherit the kingdom of God. It's not just about coupling, folks. It's about those activities that lead to that. Galatians chapter 5, verses 19 through 21. Jesus is going to draw two more clear implications from what the Father said in Mark chapter 10. One of those is that so then you're no longer two, but one flesh. And so as he reminds us of that and the implication of it, God did not specifically state that in Genesis 2 and verse 24, but Jesus recognized that it was implied. When you get married, you join a union in which you are one in the Lord. And anyone who is determined to maintain all or his or her personal preferences, likes and dislikes, and refuses to be blended into one, is not ready to get married. I say this in a simple way, don't mean it in an unkind way. If the boy has to just hold on to all his toys and that's what he's got to do, don't mess with getting married, just stay in love with your toys. But your wife's not a toy. She's a human being that you connect with in body and soul and spirit. If you must do your own thing and selfishly must have your way, then please remain single. Marriage companion unselfishly acquiesces personal preference for the good of the spouse. You're one unit. You're only half of something if that is torn apart. And when your spouse is gone, a part of you is ripped asunder and you're maimed and crippled. When you roll over in bed and she's not there ever again, when you roll over in bed and he's not there ever again, that person is never whole again. Two have been ripped apart, and you're only a fragment. And so marriage is a coupling and connecting relationship between a man and a woman. It's always been the way God said it would be. Jesus is going to say one more thing in that regard. He's going to say the most significant implication of all is that what God has joined together, let not man separate. That's God's law of marriage. We need to get the law firmly in our mind, because in my generation, when I grew up, it was all about, what about the exception clause? Isn't there an exception? Can't we look for the exception? We'll just quit being together as married couples and we'll wait for somebody else to mess up and then we'll nail them. It was precisely the mindset of the Pharisees regarding Deuteronomy 24. And Jesus says, what God has joined together, let not man separate. That's God's law of marriage. Please don't make a commitment to marriage if your focus is upon an exception clause found only in Matthew 19:9. If you enter the relationship looking for a way out, you'll create one. Please don't let anyone, a husband, a wife, parents, children, friends, judges, legislators, separate what God has joined together. May I suggest you consider this and please give me input? I'm thinking that what we're seeing is what man has joined in disregard for God's directives, God will put asunder. Just because a man or a group of men, a judge or a lawyer or a representative says, yes, we've declared this as marriage. Man may declare something as marriage, and it's not, and God will put that asunder. That will never be acceptable in God's sight. So as we think about those kind of things, if you're tempted to keep your relationship hidden from anyone, especially parents, you're in grave danger of entering a marriage that will not last. I see young people that will just kind of sneak around, try not to let their parents know that they're living together, they're sleeping together. And if you're unwilling to be honest about your relationship, if you think that's going to build a good base for marriage, may I kindly say, I think you're mistaken. And so in conclusion, and aren't you glad I cut out a lot of it? In conclusion, be careful of adopting a revisionist definition of marriage as merely a romantic emotional attachment. And that's true. That's what's happened in regard to hetero and homosexual relationships. It's no longer about a commitment, procreation. It's about, I just love that person. Emotional attachment. Marriage is a God-designed and defined covenant that binds a man and a woman together for life. And so the warning in the wise writings of Proverbs, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God? Look at that person. That is a very unwise, a very untrusting, a very unfaithful person who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. God hates divorce. Hopefully we understand why. As we look in Malachi 2, as they're complaining about God, you're just not responding to us. We're just not getting the stuff we thought we were going to get now that we've come back. Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you've dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. For the Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce, for it covers one's garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. Civil government may or may not correctly reflect God's perspective regarding what constitutes marriage. What I'm asking is, will we obey God rather than men? Please be aware that in the present context, churches are a huge target for those who are pushing this new agenda, which is now legal. Please be aware that churches will most likely experience considerable lawsuits over this. And as individuals, it's going to cost you at work. It's going to cost you at school. It's going to cost me. Years ago, when I thought I could not be thrown in jail for preaching the truth, I no longer believe that that's the case in my lifetime. Justice Anthony Kennedy was correct. He said, no union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. But he was incorrect in his definition of what constitutes marriage. Only God has the right to define as creator what marriage is and whom may participate in its privileges and responsibilities. Marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed be kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. With all this heavy tone on marriage, marriage is great, and I'm hearing some young people saying so. And I'm hearing some people have been married, 37 years? Might be in trouble now. Marriage is great when you commit to each other, when you love each other, when you trust each other, when you're faithful to each other, when you serve each other. Marriage is great. But it's great because God made it great. Because he designed it that way. And he wants us to live joyfully with the wife of our youth all the days of our vain life, which he's given us under the sun. And so he has commanded us to obey all these decrees and to fear the Lord our God, so that we might always prosper and be kept alive, as is the case today. So I ask you, are you a part of the bride of Christ? In Ephesians 4, we're told that there's one baptism and that there's one body. We're told that that one body is the church. Are you a part of that bride of Christ? Have you covenanted? Have you committed? Have you made the relationship yours in Christ by faith, trusting Him, by turning to Him, recognizing rebellion, recognizing error and saying, I'm going to go your way, and then confessing Jesus is Lord. He's master, absolute master of my life. And once you've done that, baptism is going to come quickly because you want to be submerged, immersed into Christ. You want to be buried with Him. You want to be raised with Him, and you want to walk and live with Him. If you've not done that, won't you get married to Jesus today? We'd invite you to do so as we stand and sing.